This reverse mission had three purposes. I have them up there: growth in discipleship, compassion for the poor, and global stewardship. It was a combination of work, worship, small groups, and some sightseeing. It was led by an organization called the Ministry of Money, which is one of the ministries out of Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. It was founded by a guy who was also the founder of Fellowship of Christian Athletes, which he is no longer a part of. He felt called to do this, to take treks abroad, more or less, and to challenge our view of the world. And he does this trip that we took for a month and a half. He does once a year. They also take trips to Haiti. And the trip was really divided into two parts: a group of us who went to Africa, and then some who left that portion, and then a group of some of us that were in Africa continued on to India, and were met by some people who had gone to the Philippines before that and joined us in India. And then we retreated in Thailand to process the experience. It was made up of about 17 people, plus or minus, depending on where we were. And the trip began in New York. Dan, can you just show one slide? And I left a couple days early to meet with our infamous... we got to turn the light
other lights on. No, just for a minute.
For those of you who wonder what our summer program coordinators are going to look like, that's the group. That's Dan Spencer on the right and Barb Rossing on the left. And we met for a day and a half before I left from the airport. And then we met at the airport. This is a group of us. We just completed having a Eucharist together. We met there on a Sunday evening before we took off on the trip. And it included then,
you can turn it off.
That's all I wanted to start with at this point. 3 days in Cairo, Egypt, 3 days in Khartoum, Sudan, and 11 days in Kenya. And I want to tell you, first of all, just about the experience in Africa, and then I'll show you the slides of it. I kind of feel like that's almost the best way to do it. Egypt was mostly visiting projects. We went to a bunch of Coptic churches. We went to the market. We went to some mosques. We saw the King Tut Museum, if any of you have been to Cairo. We went to the pyramids and the sphinxes. We saw the laser light show that everybody who goes to Cairo, Egypt probably sees. My impressions, Cairo is a very overpopulated city. There were tensions that grew in the group of us that were traveling there because we were unable to go to Garbage City as was planned. And in my journal I wrote, I felt we spent the day touring successful projects of Christianity. It was crowded. The Egyptians joked to relieve the stress. Men were flirtatious. There was lots of begging. There was lots of rubble all over. I had mixed impressions of women's life. But there was a lot of history. I mean, I began to think about how we take American history in what grade, and Egyptian history must take almost the entire lifetime to even begin to touch. From there, we went on to Khartoum, Sudan. And if any of you have traveled in developing countries, airports in themselves could be a whole session. In Khartoum, we were able to see refugee camps, which were as ghastly as all of the pictures are that they flash on television. We worked with the missionaries of charity there for about a day. And on the way traveling there, we got detained, we got stopped, and our driver was asked to drive to the local kind of police headquarters, where we were questioned and said that we were not supposed to be traveling in that part of the city because we didn't have permits to do that. It was a point of real tension. As you know, Sudan is a country at war, civil war. We met with a USAID guy who is probably representative of most AID personnel abroad. Sudan has had 14 declared disasters in the last year. It's much like the Bible. Plagues, famines, droughts. They have many problems. Economic decline, it's 100% inflation. They have the worst debt of any country in history. It's $13 billion. The conflict could probably be framed as one of black Africa versus Arabs, South versus North, Christian versus Muslim. It's the situation of displaced people being driven north, where a city in Khartoum of 2 million generates enough garbage for another million to live on. So all these refugees who are agriculture, rural people are driven into this city, and poverty just abounds. It has very poor infrastructure. It was hard to believe that we were in the capital city. You would walk down these dusty streets and little shacks were like listed as the department or the Ministry of Interior or something. It was just this kind of little building. In my journal, I wrote that developing aid is complex, capitalized. But we had a very exciting opportunity to meet with the house. We were driven to the house of the head of the Sudan Council of Churches, a Christian. And there we met with Dr. T, a Muslim who teaches at the university and is a peace activist with the union there. And when asked to summarize the political situation, he gave a historical and articulate account of his longtime involvement in the peace movement. On the day before this last coup happened, he was part of a multi-partisan committee that was to sign a peace negotiation statement that was, what he said, was ingenious. It was a piece of work that had brought together all the factions in Sudan. The military regime in place now is setting the stage for what is happening in Iran, he said. They are irrational, zealot fundamentalists. He told of how they had taken over the banks and have imprisoned many peace activists. Because of his international notoriety, he is safer, but he is still harassed. He was educated in Canada and his specialty is what he called third world development. He disliked being compared to other third world countries. As he said, it only promotes ideological talk. And to quote him, he says, "We can't talk ideology. Our people are dying and starving." He can't understand the U.S. Support of this present regime, even though the plan was to withdraw that aid in February. He said that was too late. I wrote he's a very courageous and intelligent man. He spoke of teaching military folks and later following up to see where the good ones had ended up in the military, and they ended up in the war zone or were discharged. It was powerful for me to see a Christian and a Muslim together, touching each other, laughing and smiling, and aligned with each other. He was taking a risk by even coming to meet with us. A very powerful day. I ache for Sudan and its people. The tension in the group was rising as we went to the airport that night. There was a curfew in the city, so our flight wasn't supposed to leave till like 3 in the morning or 4, and we had to leave at 9 o'clock in order for our taxi driver to be back into the city at 10 o'clock. He was very nervous about getting us out there. Some people in our group felt that our leaders were not sensitive to his anxiety. And so there were tensions mounting in our group then already. From there we flew on to Nairobi, Kenya, a very progressive city in many ways. And it began with a half-day retreat at an MCC, Mennonite Central Committee house there, which was beautiful. We visited the Mathari Valley, a place of severe poverty and slums. It's 10 miles long. Industrial sites. Kenya is a country of 42 ethnic groups, but they have a common language of Swahili and English. We were fortunate to hear brilliant speakers and Christian theologians. One who said, "There are many saints in the slums, but do we need to keep the slums in order to breed saints?" He wanted us to always ask what makes us become more human. Nairobi has been active in many peace initiatives, the Mozambique, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Carter himself was there while we were there. And some of you know, I've sometimes called this a celebrity tour because jogging one morning in this park across from the YMWCA, I met Jimmy Carter jogging. And then we met him another time, and he was there doing peace negotiations in relation to Namibia, I think it was. Anyway, my ideas about liberation theology were challenged. My ideas about development. One professor there said, a culture needs to have its own identity before it become Christian. Doing theology is still new in Africa, really only about 100 years or so, and our generation is really the only second generation of Christian. The experience of Jesus in Africa is different, and this must be allowed. For years, they hesitated to do their own theology because they thought it needed to be acceptable to the West. And now they're suddenly saying, we don't care what you think. We're going to interpret Jesus as we want. I think that here in the West, we tend to think of Africa as one country. My naivety. There's no voice of the continent as a whole. I was challenged in my own view of ecology, which is very different from ours. Before the colonization in Africa in 1845, they were better organized than what happened afterwards as a continent. When we met at the end to talk a little bit about Kenya with this political scientist who was fascinating, he mentioned three paradigms to frame our questions before we asked him. That was number one, that Africa has been a pawn in the East-West chessboard, indicated by this week's conference between Angola and Namibia's independence, the representation by the USSR and the United States, that more of the outside forces have been powerful than the inside ones in Africa. Secondly, in 1884, Africa was divided up. 1960s was when they achieved independence, many of those countries. And then in the 60s to 70s, the UN development and aid programs took over. And you have to know that it's also become the toxic waste disposal site for a lot of the first world. And then thirdly, Africa seems to be re-examining itself. It's more organized at the grassroots level than ever. There's an increasing number of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and they're beginning to take a fresh look at Africa's religion, which offers hope. Some of my own highlights was being able to take a train ride to Mombasa. The scenery was beautiful. It was just like out of Africa, if you've seen the movie. Being able to work in a village, a women's cooperative project, where we were able to dig in ditches, doing maverick work, to help these women who come together and are trying to extend this irrigation, this water line, so they don't have to carry water quite so far. They three times a day carry these 8-gallon jugs that I wasn't even able to lift up to get on my head. But we had to walk a distance, and we were met by these dancing and singing women who eagerly took our packs and belongings. You'll see in the slides. Then we set our stuff down and worked for a while, digging in the hot sun. And then we stopped for a feast of pot, rice, chicken, and wafers, and tea. Then we helped prepare food for them, which was maize and greens. The women prayed over it. Then we worked some more, digging and scooping. We laughed, etc. I felt so privileged to be there. Then we decided to sit, talk. But before we did that, they gave us a basin to go wash up. They had given us congas, and after bathing, we sat with the women to talk about the water project. Then we tried to balance the very heavy water jugs on our heads. What a joke. We walked back, singing and dancing, to where the others were working on another project. And we had a circle, and much like a community meeting, where this chief of this area talked. And on the way back, We were driven to the village that we had been to earlier, and we were greeted by our respective hosts where we were going to sleep for the night. Each went our own way. The evening turned out to be a highlight of my time. I was greeted by Josephine, a beautiful young 20-year-old new bride who could speak little English. She immediately told me she was a born again. That was important for me to know. And that she'd been saved. Her mother-in-law was the manager of this poultry chicken project. Her husband, Stephen, had gone to worship as he is temporarily the assistant pastor at their church. She set me down on a stool outside the kitchen after I put my bags in the bedroom I was to sleep in. I talked with her as others in the family came around. There was cooking going on in the kitchen. I had to take my contact lenses out because we'd been dry out in this really dry area all day, and they were really just killing me. And so I went into this room, and her sister-in-law, Doris, and Josephine stood next to me as I took my contact lens out. And some of you know that I have to use this kind of like little plunger to get them out. And they all started laughing and couldn't figure out what it was that I was doing. And I couldn't speak Swahili, and they couldn't understand English, so it was a joke. After a half an hour or so, her husband came home, and he spoke very good English. And then Josephine took me to bathe in a cement floor hut that had a basin and a hole in the ground. You all know what the hole was for. She also gave me a conga to wear, and after that she directed me to their bedroom where they set up a table for the four of us, Stephen, Josephine, his wife, and his sister Doris, to eat by kerosene candle. They served me a piece of gristly meat in a gravy sauce with maize mashed, white bread, buttered, and tea. It was romantic. We talked a lot, and afterwards I gave them the biscuits I'd brought. The women cleaned up as Stephen brought his mother in to talk with me, as he translated. After I'd asked her all these questions about the chickens and the project, I asked her if she had any questions for me. And in Swahili, and then he translated back, she asked me if it was true in America that we had chickens that could lay 2 eggs in a day. After the conversation, I was allowed to get ready for bed, brushing my teeth, putting on my t-shirt, etc. And then Stephen and Josephine came in along with Doris and a second cousin, a younger girl who slept on the floor. And they began singing the song about Jesus is my Lord, and I'm washed in the blood of him, alleluia. And then Stephen said prayers, and I crawled into bed. Doris came in later after bathing with a wonderful fragrance and slept next to me. The bed was hard, but I slept very well. Next morning, I was awakened by roosters crowing. I heard Doris rise, and I laid there for a while, soaking up this rich experience. I got up and met Doris outside and asked her if I could go wash up. She gave me a basin of water and took me to the toilet hut. Afterwards, I said goodbye and thanks to Stephen, who had to leave for his welding job. Josephine and Doris were doing morning chores and carrying water. I met Stephen, the 16-year-old son, William, who had been gone the night before. He spoke pretty good English and was on break from school. He will write his exams in January. He showed me around the farm with the two chicken houses, the layers and the broilers. He also showed me the garden, his parents' house, which was incomplete, and told me a lot about the family. He helped me to write all their names down, all 17 of them. While I was there, I received the best food, the first food. I was given the most comfortable bed and the first chance to bathe. They say there that guests are like the rain. We welcome it, but we're also always really glad when it ends. I was impressed with the women's physical strength. Water became a very important commodity. The sky in Africa, in Kenya, is beautiful. You'll see that in the pictures. I worshipped one day at a Lutheran church that was very boring. That could have been in southern Minnesota. Using the red hymnal. There was nothing African about it. There was a black African up on the right playing a synthesizer. But the church looked just like one in Minnesota. We got to see Karen von Blixen's house where the film Out of Africa was filmed, and saw her pen name was Isaac Dennison's, and we got to see Meryl Streep and Robert Redford's clothes as they hung on this. In the slides that I'll show you now, you'll see the Cairo, Egypt, the streets, the pyramids, some of the Nile in Sudan, the visits to some of the projects in Kenya. And I have to just preface it by saying the music is not always appropriate, especially the first part, because it's the touristy part. This music is from Africa. It's a tape I bought in Nairobi, And the song is titled Somewhere in Africa. And I guess between the words and my narration, maybe the pictures will not be so misrepresentative. You'll see the picture of the MCC retreat house, which is beautiful, and the coast of Mombasa and the Indian Ocean.
Newspaper just today in the morning. I turned to the page on Africa and I started reading. I read about famine and hunger. I read about civil strife.
Before we went on a safari, we spent a day, or half a day actually, in a silent retreat. And I just want to, these are the summary of my thoughts about Kenya. I feel more like a tourist than I expected. Some frustrations with the trip leadership. Great speakers. I'd like more discussion, not enough hands-on. Have I been changed? I happened to read in Genesis about God calling Abraham to go from your country, your kindred, and your father's house to the land I'll show you. And Abraham went. God didn't call Abraham to a place or to a work. God didn't say where to go, only that he should get out of the land where he was and go to the land I will show you. He was called primarily not to a country, but to a person. The key to his life is not a geographic location, but his relationship with God and obedience to God's will. I cannot confuse God's call with a geographic location or even with a task. God calls us to God. God's call is that we would be available, open, and willing. When Abraham obeyed in submission, he was then ready for further direction. I have to remember my life cannot be evaluated by effectiveness, success, achievement, but faithfulness. Yieldedness to God. Not great ability, but complete availability. Not spectacular success. A quiet obedience. Am I available? After that, we went on a luxurious safari, I have to confess. We spent one night in this really beautiful hotel at Amboseli Lodge. They had a swimming pool. We got there around 2 o'clock in the afternoon and then went out and saw the animals, came back and had a wonderful dinner and got up early the next morning. And the high point was being able to see the peak of Kilimanjaro on Thanksgiving Day. The sounds were incredible and being able to see the Maasai, you've heard and read about them. We went through their villages and they were right also there when we walked around. Another woman and I on the trip got scolded by a security guard. We walked beyond this place where we were supposed to in this this game park, and in his best English tried to tell us that we'd be handcuffed and eaten by tigers if we continued to go any further. But it was a beautiful place, and I don't have real good shots of the animals, but I want you to at least know we got to see them. So, I'll step in. That's for Jeanette. I have her safari hat. after the safari, then our group split up. Some of the people went on to went back home, and the rest of us went on to first Bombay for just an overnight, and then to Calcutta. I guess I didn't need to turn it off. I'm just going to narrate the few slides I have of Calcutta, and begin. I'm going to need a light, so I guess I'll use this little thing here. I dropped something, didn't I? Outside of Calcutta, we were going out to a leprosarium that I'll tell you a little more about. Does that need to be focused? Just a downtown street of Calcutta, a better one actually, just because it's not. This is right outside our hotel, and I guess to get a feel, I just want to read the postcard that I sent back to the village. This photograph, or this scene, is a very familiar one here in Calcutta, a place of 10 million people living in inhumane conditions, and despite the chaos and the crowds, life goes on, or does it? I can't begin to describe my reactions to any of this. There is constant begging in the streets by children and adults, men pulling rickshaws who look like they are near death, people defecating along the street, women making manure pies with their hands to sell as fuel, people sleeping everywhere, and a stench so strong it keeps me awake. We were very fortunate to attend 6 a.m. Mass today at the Sisters of Charity's mother house, and Mother Teresa was there. We get to meet with her tomorrow after daily morning mass and before going to our work assignments for the week. Pray that I can let myself be touched by this hell. I would like to not know this is here. I am paralyzed to use a camera, so I wanted to write you all with my freshest reactions. I am anxious to come home. We had a daily schedule of getting up early in the morning to walk about 2.5 miles from here through these streets to the Mother Teresa's, it's called the Mother House, where they worship every morning at, they start at 5:45. And they have about an hour mass, and then they serve like sort of tea after there, and all the volunteers are usually there along with all of the sisters. And as you walk through these streets in the morning, people are sleeping everywhere, and it's dark. It was dark. You'd stumble over people sometimes, and the city was just kind of starting to come alive, and you felt like you were walking through people's living rooms. And then when we'd get to the mother house, it was always such an interesting kind of contrast, because you go in this room, it's very stark, and they just worshipped on mats, there'd be these beautiful room of about probably 100 nuns with their white saris and the blue stripe, and then the sun would start to pour in from the outside. It was really hot, and you'd hear the noise from the city, the streets, starting to come in, and sometimes it would go louder than what the speaking or the singing was, and yet the sunlight would sort of begin to shine into this room with all these white saris and the praying and the singing, and it was just a fascinating kind of experience. This is just to show the British influence. It's a large, I remember what the name of it was now, but it's important, I think, to remember that the city is filled with a lot of actually men who have moved into the city to work, and they're separated from their families, and so There's also another whole population of girls, and they show these violent movies, and there's these signs up there that are posted everywhere, and different times in the street we'd be walking, and these movies would be letting out in the afternoon, and they would be almost entirely all men that would attend them. This is our taxi driver, and he and I got along really well. And he wanted me to take his picture. And that was a good way sometimes, often in the uncomfortable moments that you'd want a shot, is to let them take a picture of you or something else. But he was nice enough to, they drive all over the place. It was the most horrendous experience to take the taxi from the airport to the hotel. I was never so scared in all my life. Those are the cow pies made into patties. This was a cathedral there, that along with the Hindu temples were sort of respites in all the chaos. This was inside. Oops. That's another shot of, this was actually where we ate. It looks pretty nice, and these were our waiters, and they also were happy to let me take their picture, and it was something to have a picture of, I guess. We stayed in a British hotel that would seemed extravagant compared to the rest of the place. It was not by any means, but it was a fascinating time to fly into India. The day we flew in, the elections were happening, and there was a bombing about a half a block at a voting booth or poll the day we arrived. And so the country was sort of alive with political activity. This is the leprosarium that we visited that was started by Mother Teresa outside of the city. We had to take a train there. And I have a number of shots of this. This clinic gets about 50 new cases a day. Let's see, some of my notes. These are some of the lepers. Most of them are blind, but we entered into this one particular section, and they burst into song about us and sang a song in English that was, Jesus cleanses me or helps me to see, or can't exactly remember what the words were, but and that's the missionaries of charity you might be familiar with. They weave out at this leprosarium. The people stay there, and weaving is a big thing, and those are the cloth that's being woven for their saris for them. The families come and live right there. They're dyeing the cloth. This cloth that I have up here over the thing is what's on the sheets at the place where I volunteered. I wanted to bring it back and use it as my own sheet to remember the experience, and that cloth there was purchased at this leprosarium. And here's these fellas singing for us. It was wonderful. This is the priest there on the left, the Brothers of Charity that operate this clinic. It's an amazing, this is their garden. Beautiful. They had hogs. And we're fortunate to have an Indian fellow by the name of Sanjay who was working for World Vision, who was traveling with us and covering. But he knew Calcutta really well, had grown up there, and took us on wonderful night train trips through the city when it was much more, possible to just even travel and move about. There's 500 people who live at this leprosarium. 120 families. They have 2,500 outpatients. And like I said, there are 4 million people in India with leprosy. Many of them become or were professional beggars. One girl had been brought there. That's our group outside the leprosarium. After the village had already dug a grave for her, and there's still severe stigma attached to it. This is outside the mother house where Mother Teresa lives. There's a couple of sisters right down there in the left-hand corner. You go down this alleyway to the left, and that is where you enter. That's outside her door when it's dark, it's terrible. You enter there. This is one of their vans that they have at one of their work sites. This was a really powerful experience. That's Father Ed La Jolla. He's a Belgian guy, and he's the priest who was in Calcutta when Mother started her order, and he kind of became her spiritual director, still is. I think he's about 85. And wrote, he's the only one that Mother Teresa has asked to write about her. She feels many people have written stuff that's been a misrepresentation of her and what her work is about. He was delightful. We got there and he served us these pastries and we spent the afternoon with him. He's written 3 books. One is just now to be released this year. He was in the PBS special about her and was telling us about how he'd been flown to this other city, the one where the Taj Mahal is, I can't remember, and how he for 4.5 hours was under these lights and said, turn this way, and all for only 3.5 minutes. And afterwards I asked him if he felt that the movie was representation of her, and he says, oh, I never watched it. Why would I need to see it? This is outside Premdon, the one of the sites that I worked at, where it's mostly people that are aged and retarded. And we did a daily routine of arriving there about 8:30 and helping with bathing and just basic maintenance. Probably the most interesting case there, I've talked about it in a hunger awareness talk, was a woman that was brought there who was raised by bears. And kind of just that last year, it started to work, to walk upright. Otherwise, she was always on all 4 hands, or 4 limbs, and spoke. And actually, she really looked like a bear. It was amazing. It was really inappropriate to take pictures inside, but this was the outside of it. You walk down through these steps through the door there and on the other side. This was our very last morning at the mother house, known as the Barefoot. This is the one of the 6 consulate women. She could be the one that was now named to replace Mother Teresa. But she oversees all of the novices, the novitia, and told us how women enter into the order. This is inside the mother house, just outside the worship space. That's some of the people in our group. The couple on their left are a Lutheran pastor and his wife from Tacoma. Maltines, who've been here on staff, Elmer's gone to that church, and Paul and Joyce Hoffman. One person at our hotel said, Calcutta is a dying city that will not die. Underneath all the chaos, there is an order. The life expectancy of men there is 55 and of women it's 60. 70% illiteracy. This priest who spoke to us said there are basically 3 poverties in this city: sexual, intellectual, and of the heart. He said the people are much like in New York, kind of real controlled and just ready to lash out. When we were traveling back in the taxi from our work site one day, our taxi driver hit a pedestrian. That's not uncommon there. But we were told that he couldn't even get out to maybe help any assistance because he would be literally murdered by the people in the street for that act. One thing I wrote in my journal about the death of a woman at the site I worked was that After having lived like an animal, she'll be allowed to die like an angel. I just want to read you what I wrote about leaving Calcutta. I'm ready to leave this city. I hate it. The crowds, the filth, the beggars, the air, the smell, the animals, people spitting, dirty everything, the traffic, feces, I'm sick of it all. God, how can these people live like this? Much less do I want to help it. I can't wait to leave. I hate what it's done to my spirit, my clothes, my body, my soul. What a god-awful place. Is this life? I hope I can make some sense out of this hell. And when I shampooed my hair that night, it was, the suds were just black. The volunteers were a powerful part of the experience also. They come from all over the world. It was fascinating to have all these languages being spoken while you're taking care of dying people. Riding the train at night and seeing people sleep just, you know, feet from these train tracks, and that being their house. I want to just close with a Thomas Merton quote about my thoughts about what can you do about Calcutta. Do not depend on the hope of results. When you're doing the sort of work you have that you are, you've taken on, you may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and achieve no result at all. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the rightness, the truth of the work itself. The big results are not in your hands or mine, but they suddenly happen, and we can share in them. But there is no point in building our lives on this personal satisfaction which may be denied to us, and which, after all, is not that important. Okay. From Calcutta, we went to Thailand, and that was to be a retreat to sort of process the whole four and a half weeks that had happened before us. We landed in Bangkok and spent a day doing some touristy things in Bangkok. And I just want to show you the slides of that portion. Would you turn and just...
Is there another rack?
Right?
Is there another rack?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's right down below. I'll do that. It's not much. Just a few.
Just press that button, that's it.
Which one? Oh, I see. We saw the great and little Buddha temple. And I'll just show you these. Oh my God. If you ever get to Bangkok, stay in the YMCA. It's just incredible and very cheap and very nice. It was a fascinating contrast. Then we went to the floating markets and took a boat ride, and these were just some of the sights along the way. This is before we went into our silent retreat down at Pattaya, south of Bangkok. Okay. We went then, the next day we took a bus and went down to what was called the Baptist Conference Center. I want, before I show you some of the slides that I want to just read you some things I wrote during that silent retreat. The world is very connected. Jesus is experienced differently, yet his love is universal. The poor need our solidarity, but in a different way than paternalism. Otherwise, it becomes mental slavery. What makes me become more human? Have I become more human when I say I feel freer? I have more questions. What does it mean to be at peace with poverty? Have I moved from becoming a U.S. citizen to a global citizen? It was a powerful time to be traveling in November. If any of you remember, it was the month that the wall came down. The priests were killed in El Salvador. Things erupted in the Philippines, and then the elections were going on in India. And we felt like daily we were bombarded with these world events, and it was great fun for me to be able to read them in newspapers abroad. Has my compassion increased? I think I'm getting used to the stink. It is a new day. These slides now that I'm going to show are just some of the retreat. You'll see the beautiful Gulf of Thailand. I'd never been silent for 3 days before, and that was a powerful experience after doing all of this traveling. We ate our meals silently, and we just worshipped, and that was the only thing that we did, and just spent a lot of time walking the beach. Two other people you'll see in the picture got up with me every morning, and we watched the dawn and the sunrise. And then the very last morning there, we did a Eucharist together at this site, which is actually at the end of the beach. And this is garbage right here that you're looking at as the sun came up.
I will love you more than me and more than yesterday. If you can but prove to me you are the new day. Send the sun in time for dawn. Let the birds all hail the morning. Love of life will at me say, you are the new day. When I lay me down at night, knowing we must pray, for the girl that this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as humans saw could slow worlds and end it all. Lie around me where they fall before the new day.
Ecology conference going on.
Hope is my philosophy, just these days in which to be. Love of life means hope for me, for the new day. Thank you.
God makes all things new. It truly was a new day to be home. The hope that I found and saw in the eyes of the children, they were a sign to me that there was hope. They seemed not yet drained by the reality of some of their adults' existence, and their bright eyes and their flashing smiles were warm and inviting. And in the words of Mother Teresa, I think they are doing something beautiful for Jesus.
Tell the children in every nation, Rome obeying for segregation. Tell the children in every land, Rome oppression and hunger.